Right, well, good afternoon, brethren. Today we're going to continue reading through the book of Genesis. We got as far as chapter 5 last time, and as I've said before, the idea is to try to go fairly quickly through the story flow of Genesis, and we'll stop here and there and just try to add a bit more understanding where it might seem to be particularly helpful. But fundamentally, we're trying to just read through the book and to learn as much as we can as we do so. So last time we got to the end of Genesis chapter 5, which brings us right up pretty much to the days of Noah. And one of the comments I made in the last time we spoke was about just how long these individuals lived. You've got people living, you know, 800 and 900 years. And in chapter 5, verse 27, we read of the man who lived longest of all, who was Methuselah. That's a term sometimes people talk about, an old person being a Methuselah, because it signifies great age. And Methuselah was 969 years old, and he died, which is, you know, an incredible age. That's going to bring us back from today almost to the days of the Norman Conquest, you know, in 1066 and so on. It's a great age. And one of the things I was trying to bring out was just how the people in those days overlapped with each other. And I looked at a chart earlier today. Adam and Methuselah, they overlapped by 250 years. In other words, Methuselah was 250 years old when Adam died. So they would have known each other, I suspect, really quite well. And all the things that Adam had learned, his experiences in the Garden of Eden, perhaps, I've got to say, exaggerated and corrupted, he could have passed on quite easily to Methuselah, because they lived together for 250 years. And Methuselah died when? Well, he died the year of the flood. It's quite possible Methuselah turned out to be perhaps a rather wicked individual, and so he died quite likely in the flood itself, which means, since Noah was 600 when the flood started, that Noah and Methuselah lived side by side for 600 years. So Adam lived with Methuselah for 250 years. Methuselah lived with Noah for 600 years. So it's quite easy to understand how stories could pass along quite easily from one to another, because they lived such long lives. There's only Adam, Methuselah, and Noah, right from the Garden of Eden all the way down to the flood. And even Shem, who was one of Noah's sons, Shem was born about 100 years before the flood, and Shem lived on for hundreds of years after the flood and almost outlived Abraham. In other words, Abraham was quite an old man before Shem died. I mean, these people lived such huge stretches of time that really you get Adam, Methuselah, Noah, Shem, and Abraham. That's a long line, but only really four generations in one way of looking at it. Okay, just wanted to point out there just how long-lived these people were, and the fact they could actually side-by-side live together. Now chapter 6, taking up where we left off, starting in verse 1. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, and I've got a note in my margin here that says that the population of the earth at this time could have been about 1 billion. People sometimes think, when they look back in time, that there's only a few thousand people on the earth in the days of Noah, just a few small little towns with 80 people or 100 people in them, but the earth was really quite populous. Whether the billion is correct, no easy way to tell, but that's what one person has calculated. Verse 2, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives, or took women, for themselves of all whom they chose. Mr. Armstrong's belief was that at this time, that the different races, the black race, and the yellow race, and the white race, were busy trying to integrate, to mix between each other, which God did not want. If you like, God had color-coded the human race. There were some who were black, some who were yellow, some who were white, and the intention was that the main races would remain separate. But as always, man likes to rebel, and seemingly racial integration was one of the main causes of the violence and so on of these days. And the Eternal said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those are the mighty men of old, who were of old, men of renown." And it does say there were giants on the earth. That doesn't necessarily mean giant in terms of height or tallness, although it could do that. But it certainly means individuals who were very powerful. And there are some archaeological records that show that there were some very powerfully built individuals in these ancient days, highly muscled, strong, powerful physically, very dominant. Verse 5, "Then the Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." And this is quite an impressive scripture in some ways. If you think about it, it says that every intent of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. I think the King James says every imagination of man's heart was only evil continually. I mean, we're looking there at a civilization possibly numbering as many as a billion people, where every thought of everybody's heart was just evil all the time. I mean, can we imagine a world like that? We think the world today is pretty bad. And when you see what's on the TV and read the newspapers and so on, and there's drugs and crime and pornography and perversion and corruption, we think it's pretty bad today. But you read that and it just says that the wickedness of man was great. Every intent of the thoughts of his heart, not just what men did that was evil, but the very imagination, the thinking was just evil continually, non-stop, 24/7. I mean, that's a pretty awful society to contemplate. Verse 6, "And the Eternal was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart." You know, it's hard to imagine that God just looking down and being so taken aback by the level of corruption and perversion and violence and filth that even people's imaginations just ran rampant with every perversity that was possible. I think God was just taken aback and just thought, wow, that's got so bad so quickly. That is absolutely incredible. It makes you wonder whether this project is worth continuing with. So the Eternal said, "I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." It's got so bad so quickly, it almost took God's breath away. Verse 8, "But," thankfully the story doesn't end there, "Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal." So here's one man out of possibly a billion, and this man God recognizes as something a bit different about Noah. This is the genealogy of Noah. "Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God." So Noah, it tells us here, was a good man. He was an upright man, a just man. It says perfect in his generations. Well, no man is perfect spiritually, that's for sure. And Noah was no different. Mr. Armstrong's belief here was that this referred to Noah's genealogy. Unlike everybody else, it seems, he had not got mixed up with different colored races. His genealogy, his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, were all of the one direct line going all the way back to Adam. So he was, if you like, blameless or pure in his pedigree, in his racial background. "And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence." Now, as we said last time, Genesis chapters 1 to 11 cover a whole 2,000 years of man's history. The rest of the Bible, and it's quite a thick book, takes us all the way down to the days of the apostles, and it completes with the writings of the apostle John around about 90 AD. So that means that the first 11 chapters of the Bible cover 2,000 years, and all the rest of the Bible covers 2,000 years. So in Genesis 1 to 11, everything is pretty brief. It doesn't go into great detail. It just hurries along with a little snapshot here and there. But when it tells us that the earth was corrupt before God and filled with violence, you have to use your own imagination and think, well, what does it mean, filled with violence? It doesn't say warfare exactly. It says violence. That implies that people just killed and they fought and they were violent and they're brutal to each other. And it says the earth was filled with such violence. It wasn't localized in perhaps one city over here and one area over there. The earth itself, God just looked down, and wherever he looked, people's imaginations were evil continually. There was violence absolutely everywhere. There had been maiming, rape no doubt, murder, probably torture, every type of vile conduct you can think of. The earth was a vile, horrible, disgusting place. And those babies who were born into that society had got no hope. The only example they could see around them was of violence and perversion and filth and greed and stealing and so on. They would grow up with that example. That's the example they would see. That's the example they would follow. And they would just add even more violence and corruption. And if you imagine the likes of people like, say, Saddam Hussein and Adolf Hitler and people like Pol Pot, and the people that we know in our recent history have been violent and megalomaniacs. Well, human nature was like that then. There were plenty of them. It was just unrestrained violence. Verse 12, so God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Or the King James Version says, all flesh had corrupted his way on the earth, possibly referring to God's way. And God said to Noah, so here's God actually speaking now to this one man, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So he announced what would have been rather a shock to Noah, Noah, I'm going to wipe out the lot. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms or compartments inside the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And although people aren't 100% sure exactly how big a cubit is, there are two or three different cubits that we're aware of, it's quite likely that the ark was about nearly 600 feet long, about 94-95 feet in width, and about 56 feet high. 56 feet would be about the height of a 5 or 6 story building. And if that's the case, if those were its dimensions, then you can work out that it had about 3 million cubic feet of space, and would have had a displacement in terms of being a ship of about 66,000 tons. So as big as a 66,000 ton vessel. And that's a pretty big ship. There were no ships on the earth right up to the last sort of century, 150 years, of that size. And people ask, well, how could all the animals on the earth fit into, a ship, into the ark? Surely it must be a fairy tale. Surely it must be a myth, because you can't get all the animals of the earth into one single boat, can you? I mean, think of elephants. They're big beasts. And think about the giraffes, they're huge animals as well. What about the hippopotamus and the rhinoceros and the horses and the oxen? I mean, surely the ark wouldn't be big enough to contain all the animals that allegedly went into it. So isn't this all just a Jewish fairy tale? Well, of course, you can look at it another way, which is that you don't have to take full-grown elephants into an ark. You could take, two young elephants. Much smaller. You could take two young sort of, what might they be, teenage giraffes into the ark, a bit smaller. You could take some young hippos into the ark. They'd be a bit smaller. And so you could save a wee bit of space that way. But some of the facts that we can find out are that 60% of the animals on the earth live in the sea. Whales, octopus, squid, all the fish and so on. 70% of the animals on the earth are actually insects. land animals are insects. The remainder of Earth's animals are in average size the size of a rhesus monkey. Rhesus monkey is quite a small monkey, and that's the average size animal, because you've got big elephants and giraffes, you've also got rabbits, you've got squirrels, you've got mice, you've got hedgehogs, you've got water voles. So there are many very small animals, there's cats and there's dogs, and of course you could bring into the ark puppies rather than full grown adult dogs and so on. So if the average sized animal is the size of a rhesus monkey, and scientists have worked that out to be the case, they know that you can keep an animal that size in a cage only 15 cubic feet in size. That's about 2 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet or whatever. And you can keep an animal in that quite happily for a couple of 3 years. So, since there are 18,000 species on the Earth of animals of the size of a rhesus monkey, and you take in two, that's a male and a female, and each one has got 15 cubic feet to live happily in, according to zookeepers, then that means that you could take all the animals on the Earth into the ark, and it would use up about 600,000 cubic feet. 600,000. Well, the ark's dimensions were 3 million cubic feet. So according to that calculation, 80% of the ark was empty, which is quite remarkable. Of course, there'd be hay and vegetables and things to feed lots of the animals, but even there, it's quite possible God could put some of the animals into hibernation, you know, the bears and the hamsters and so on, so they could be sleeping most of the time through the flood and not even require any mucking out or feeding. Who knows? But the point is that it's quite easy by working out a few things to show that the ark was plenty big enough to carry all the animals it had to carry with plenty of room left over. No problem at all. Anyway, carrying on the story, verse 16, you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. So there appears to be just the one door on the side of this ship. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. So one at the top, one in the middle, and one down towards the bottom. And behold, I myself am bringing the flood of waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, in which is the breath of life. And everything that is on the earth shall die. Everything that's got the breath of life. Obviously, fish wouldn't be affected because they're in the water and they're already quite safe. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you, which altogether makes just eight people. And eight people out of about a billion is not very many. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive, and they will come to you, says God. You haven't got to go out and hunt them down necessarily. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. And I think so would we, because if God says, I'm going to flood the earth and wipe away all life, but I'm going to offer you a way of protection, a place of safety, we might say, then I think we would be very keen to respond to that. Excuse me. On to chapter 7. Then the Eternal said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. And of course, you know, building the ark could have been a major project. And I think we can understand that it would have taken a lot of effort and energy and hard work and no doubt many blisters and aching muscles and a lot of cooperation from other people to get this job done. You shall take with you seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female. And notice that here, even before the flood, some animals were referred to as clean animals, and others were clearly the opposite, unclean animals. And whereas the unclean would go in two by two, the clean, it says here, take in seven of each, you know, seven males, seven females. Two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. For after seven more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. So one more week to go. Time ticking away here. And Noah did according to all that the Eternal commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was on the earth. So Noah, with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood, of clean beasts, of beasts that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth. Two by two they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And, I mean, we've seen, we know that animals do migrate. We get swallows here in the summertime that, you know, they head down south to warmer climates in the autumn. They come up here in the sort of late spring, early summer. There are butterflies that fly all the way down the coast of California, the monarch butterflies. There are salmon that can, you know, swim all the way across the Atlantic and back again. So God's able to reach into the minds of animals and make them sort of migrate and come all the way here, in this case, to Noah's Ark, where they would be protected from the floodwaters. Verse 10, and it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. So there's two things there. It's not just a question of raining from above. Notice also that the fountains of the great deep were broken up. So the earth itself broke up, and huge geysers and so on, water just poured out from the earth from underneath. And there are great deeps of water under this earth, multiple billions of gallons underground. So what happened here was that there were earthquakes, and the earth broke apart, and water just gushed up by the billions of gallons. Simultaneously to that, the windows of heaven were opened. And if there was indeed a water vapor canopy, as many scientists believe, then that would have apparently started to just pour down onto the earth as well. And the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And the number 40, I think we know, has got some significance in the Bible. It often represents a time of testing. There's 40 days and 40 nights here. And, you know, Jesus was tested, 40 days and 40 nights fasting. And you've got the situation of Moses, 40 years in the wilderness, and 40 years, of course, before they headed into the promised land. And 40 is quite a significant number. So the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark, they and every beast after its kind, all cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh in which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Eternal shut him in. So it looks like the door was shut from the outside miraculously. And we can only wonder what people must have thought at that time, because there would have been surely tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands living close to Noah and his family. Noah, we know, was a preacher of righteousness, according to the Apostle Peter. So Noah would have preached, you know, what is right. He would have preached what is proper. He would probably have warned and preached about the coming flood. And people scoffed at him. They paid no regard. They laughed at him, and they probably were rather violent towards him. There certainly are some stories that Noah had to have a security deputation to protect him. And if you think about it, I mean, what would Satan be doing in these days? We know Satan tried to kill Jesus when he was born, using King Herod and his armies to slaughter all the young boys up to the age of two and so on. And here Noah is going to be saved and protected with his family. I'm sure it would suit Satan's purpose if he could kill off Noah and his family, because everybody else was already lost. They were already wicked and iniquitous, and God himself is going to wipe them out. So if Satan could wipe out Noah by stirring up hatred and violence against him, then that would be curtains as far as Satan's concerned to God's plan. So no doubt Noah had some pretty interesting experiences, and we'll hear about them one of these days. Verse 17. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. And no doubt at that stage many people who had scoffed and joked and ridiculed and Noah would have got perhaps second thoughts. Well, just a minute. It's getting pretty dark out there, and the clouds are coming way down low. And can you hear a sound? And what's that noise? It's the earth breaking up. And what's this? And water comes gushing out, cascading down the hills, and the rain starts pouring. And then people start to just get a bit of doubt in their minds and look at this ship there with the door now miraculously sealed, no more entrance to it. And then the waters start to pour down, and the rivers burst their banks, and then people start to just get a bit fearful. And of course, it's been a pretty dramatic time. And no doubt at that stage, many people would have headed towards the ark and been beating in the side of it, you know, knocking, trying to get in, you know, let us in, Noah. You know, we believe you now, open the door. But Noah couldn't. He hadn't shut the door. Anyway, verse 18, the waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. Now, we don't know how high the mountains exactly were in those days. I doubt if it was the Mount Everest at 30,000 feet high, but the mountains might have been 4,000, 5,000 feet perhaps in those days. But however high they were now underwater. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, cattle, beasts, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land, died. So he, that's God, destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So that's pretty dramatic. If there were indeed a billion people, you've now got a billion human carcasses, plus the carcasses of all the animals, all floating about in this water as it sort of, as the waves went backwards and forwards and so on, as the ground heaved and more waters came up from the deep and so on, all those bodies everywhere, quite an unsightly mess. Chapter 8. Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. So God started to intervene here and start to deal with the weather, and the rain stopped, the windows of heaven were stopped, and the water which was pouring out of the deep places of the earth underground also stopped. And the waters receded continually from the earth. So the water that was on top of the earth now, the deep sea, started to drain away again, going back underground in many, many cases, and it's still there, of course, today. So the waters start to recede continually, sort of going to and fro from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. So the waters go down, you know, little by little, and eventually the ark grounds itself on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So the water's now far enough down that you can actually see some land. So it came to pass at the end of 40 more days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Then he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had abated from the face of the ground. Now, the mountains were now sort of, if you like, poking through the water. But how about the actual land itself? Was it now, was it dry land there? Were there sort of leaves and trees and bushes available? But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Now, of course, some people say the flood was a localized flood. You know, just affected a small part of Mesopotamia, and that the rest of the earth was unaffected, which is, you know, baloney. You know, you see fossils all over the entire earth, and broken bones and bodies of animals all crushed together by some mud and water and so on. And you find that, you know, in Scotland, you find it up in the North Pole, you find it all across the USA and all the way down through South America. This was a worldwide sort of a dramatic event. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out from the ark. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And Noah knew that the waters had abated from the earth. So this time the little dove has managed to actually find some leaves growing on a small, you know, fresh olive tree. So he waited yet another 7 days, and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him any more. She had enough of being in the ark. Not a bad place in the event of a flood, but you can have too much of the ark. And at this stage, she'd found somewhere a bit more attractive, and she was off, and that was the end of that little dove. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, obviously somebody was keeping a calendar, that the waters were dried up from the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. So the water was all gone now back into the seas, back into the oceans, and of course the huge volume of it back underground. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth, and be fruitful, and multiply on the earth." So, that's pretty good. Release all the animals, let them race out there, and then they can be fruitful and multiply. So Noah went out, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on the earth, according to their families, went out of the ark. And it must have been in some ways a little bit like it was in the days of Adam and Eve. When Adam was first created, he was only one. There was one human being on the earth, Adam. And the whole world, you know, lay before him. And here it was not exactly dissimilar. This time there's only eight people. Eight people only on the entire earth. I mean, we're talking here about a pretty small beginning again. There's Noah, age 600 odd, and his wife, presumably not far off that in terms of years. There's Shem, Ham and Japheth, and their three wives. Just eight people standing there on the ground beside the ark, all the animals coming out, the birds flying off, heading for the trees and so on. And that's it. The whole world, you know, all those thousands and thousands of square miles of planet Earth, just waiting to be investigated and explored and occupied and inhabited, and just eight human beings on the face of the whole earth. Really must have been a very sobering time, because don't forget that Noah must have been perplexed and bothered for centuries by the violence and the corruption and perversion of the hundreds of thousands and millions that he'd been familiar with. And here now, just him and his immediate family, and that's all there is. Verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Eternal, and took of every clean animal, and of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So, worshipping God by means of animal sacrifices goes a long way back. and Eternal smelled a soothing aroma. Then Eternal said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Which I think we know pretty much, that people can be pretty evil quite young. It doesn't say evil from being a baby, but it doesn't take long after babyhood before Satan starts to inject his values into human beings. And of course, by the time you get to 2 or 3, most youngsters are quite jealous and greedy and quite selfish. And by the time they get to 5 or 10, it's well and truly evident. So as God himself says here, the imagination of man's heart is evil indeed from his youth, from his youngest years. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. That's a promise from God. Chapter 9. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. You know, it's pretty empty at the moment. There's only the 8 of you. But get busy, and have families, and populate the earth again. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. So people say, oh, that means you can eat snakes, and you can eat ant eaters, and you can eat ants as well, thinking about it. And you can eat alligators and crocodiles, because it says here, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. That's what God said, didn't he? But that could hardly be the case. It's only a few pages later that we find in Leviticus and Deuteronomy the clean and unclean animals. And we know that Jesus and his disciples carefully ate only the clean animals, and Peter said as much in Acts chapter 10. The key here really is, it says, I have given you all things even as the green herbs. Now, it doesn't mean herbs in the sense of parsley and thyme. The word here that is translated herbs just means, vegetation, vegetables, whether it's tomatoes, which aren't, of course, green, but they're green when they start off, of course. But you get vegetables like lettuce and cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower and peas and beans and things of that nature. But you can't eat everything, every plant that grows. You can't eat deadly nightshade. You can't eat poison ivy. And so as you choose the healthy green herbs and plants, so you choose the healthy animals. And they are, of course, listed later in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, as indeed are the fish. You can't eat catfish, you can't eat octopus, you can't eat clams, you can't eat oysters. Well, you can, but they're not very healthy. But you should not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. So you're not to eat the blood of these clean animals. Surely, for your lifeblood, I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I'll require it, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I'll require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. So there's a death penalty mentioned here, an administration of death, really, that if somebody sheds a man's blood and kills him, then he's got to pay the death penalty. Dropping down to verse 8. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. Now, a covenant is an agreement, a binding commitment, which God is now making with Noah and his three sons. With you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. And this is it. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And that's God's covenant. He'd done it once. It served his purpose. It swept away and washed away all the filth and perversion and corruption and dirt and killing and maiming and torture that was there. I mean, God couldn't allow really many more people to be born into that society. It was just really, it was too painful to behold. So God had done that. He'd washed the earth and cleansed it with the waters of the flood. But he said, that's it. I'm not going to do that again. That was a one-off. It won't happen again. And that's my covenant. That's my formal commitment to you. Verse 12. And God said, this is a sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I've established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. So this covenant actually isn't just with Noah. This covenant is with the hedgehogs and the rabbits and the armadillos and the dolphins and so on. Every living creature on the earth has this special covenant that God will not flood the earth. And the rainbow is the sign of that covenant. And God says when he sees rainbows, it'll remind him. And so when you and I see a rainbow, we could at least pause just for a moment and just think, oh, there it is, the rainbow. That's a reminder of Genesis. That's a reminder the earth was flooded once upon a time. And that's a reminder to us that God has made a perpetual covenant with all living flesh, that it will never again flood and destroy, you know, all flesh off the earth. Dropping down now to verse 18. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. That's mentioned for a particular reason, which will become clear in a moment or two. And these names of the three sons of Noah have good meanings. Shem apparently means a leader. Shem would be a leader. That's what his name means. Ham means hot or enraged or short-tempered. And Japheth means enlargement or spreading out. These appear to be the basic meanings of their names. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these three, or from these, the whole earth was populated. And if you look around the earth today, there's about 6 billion people, and the 6 billion people on the earth today are all descended from Shem and Ham and Japheth. Simple as that. Verse 20. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk, and became uncovered in his tent. So Noah had a little bit too much of the bubbly, whether that's because it was a bit stronger than he expected, or he got carried away, or was depressed, or whatever. We can't tell for sure, but he certainly drank more than was wise, and I think the Bible makes it fairly plain that God's men were not perfect. King David's story is littered with things that David did regret, and we all know about them because they're all published in the Bible for millions to read. And Noah, like God's men generally, made a few mistakes, and this was one of them. He got badly pie-eyed and was left naked and drunk in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. And the word for nakedness there in Hebrew implies shameful nakedness. It wasn't just that he was unclothed, there was something shameful about his appearance, about the situation he was in. And we see there that Ham, the father of Canaan, if you just hold your place for a moment and look at chapter 10 of Genesis and verse 6, you see the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. So Ham was the father of at least four sons who are identified. The youngest of his four sons was Canaan. So to say that Ham's the father of Canaan is intriguing, because Ham's the father of Cush, first of all, and then Mizraim, and then Put, and then Canaan. Canaan's only one of his sons, and the youngest one. So So back to verse 22 of chapter 9. Ham, the father of Canaan. Why is Canaan mentioned here? Why is he singled out? Because Ham's the father of others besides. But Ham, the father of Canaan, his youngest son, remember, saw the nakedness of his father, told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth, they didn't sort of walk in and look at their sort of naked father. They understood, whoops, is that right? There's a situation in there that's rather shameful. Right, okay. They took a garment, laid it on their shoulders, and went backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. So they, as it says, their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's circumstances. They went in backwards with this garment, perhaps a coat or a robe of some sort, and just walked backwards and just draped it over their father's naked body. Verse 24. So Noah awoke from his wine, with a hangover no doubt, and knew what his younger son had done to him. Whose younger son? Noah's younger son? Or is it, in fact, Ham's younger son, Canaan? Remember, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness? If you look, we know the sons of Noah are Shem, Ham, and Japheth. You know, Ham isn't the younger son. So when it talks here about Noah awoke from his wine and knew what Ham's younger son, Canaan, had done to him. And it seems, from what we can make out, that Canaan, the younger son of Ham, had actually molested his grandfather. So that's why you then get to verse 25. Then he, Noah, said, cursed be Canaan. That's why Canaan is cursed, because it's Canaan, the younger son of Ham, who's been culpable here. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brethren. But he said, blessed be the Eternal, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. So Canaan, the line of Canaan, gets a rather hefty curse here because of his behavior. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So Noah lived an immense length of time, you know, 350 years. So he lived 600 years before the flood, nearly 400 years after the flood. You know, really quite incredible. And of course, you know, Shem continues for a long time yet. Chapter 10. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. And we won't dwell too much on these, but chapter 10 does give us the early origins of nearly all the nations of the earth that we see today. And it is possible to track back, you know, from France and Germany and from India and Pakistan, the people of Brazil, the Red Indian tribes of North America. You can track them all back, if you do the work, all the way back to chapter 10. And many of these people here, the sons of Japheth and Gomer and so on, turn out to be some of the people of China and Japan and Russia and so on. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath and Togarmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim. From these were the coastland peoples of the Gentiles. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his own language, according to their families and to their nations. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put and Canaan. Mizraim being what Egypt is actually called. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havila, Sabta, Rama, Sabtika, and the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. And these were essentially black in color. Cush begot Nimrod, so you've got Ham, remember? And then Cush was his oldest son, it was black, and Cush begot Nimrod. So you got Noah, Ham, Cush, Nimrod. So Nimrod was Noah's, wherever he was, great-great-grandson or something like that. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. And some translations say that Nimrod was a mighty hunter against the Eternal. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before or against the Eternal. Now, there's an awful lot of information about Nimrod, which we can't take time to divert into here, otherwise we won't get as far as I want today. But Nimrod was an incredible individual. He was the despot leader of the world in these days. He was a hunter, it seems, not only of animals, but of other people. And took the famous way of becoming number one by bumping off all the opposition. So he was a hunter, he had his own subservient henchmen, and he basically helped to become, you know, the number one individual of those days, a strong, powerful dictator who did a great deal in terms of helping people become even more wicked than before. And perhaps we'll look into that another time, another day. But the Nimrod, I think we know he's actually the source of much of today's religions, the Babylon of religion that we have today. If you track it all the way back, it goes all the way back to ancient Babylon and to the days of Nimrod and his mother oblique wife Semiramis and so on. Verse 10, in the beginning of his kingdom, because he had a kingdom, he was a ruler, he was a strong despot of the day, he was a Saddam Hussein of this time. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, or Babylon, I think is otherwise referred to, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. So he was a city builder. You know, he brought people under his control. He was their benefactor. He was their protector. He was the one that no doubt taxed them. And he was the boss man over many cities. Mizraim begot Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Naphtuhim, Pathrusim, and Kazluhim, from whom came the Philistines and the Kaphtorim. I don't think we know an awful lot about these, at least I don't. But there is that big book that Mr. Herman Hay produced 40 years ago. I guess chapters 1 and 2, or volumes 1 and 2 of, what's it called?
Compendium
of the Nations, yep. And that does track many of these tribes all the way back. Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, the Sinite, the Arvadite, the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. Afterwards, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza. Then as you go towards Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Zeboim, as far as Lesha. And I think we recognize the two towns there of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, these were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, and in their nations. And it seems quite evident when you think about Ham was the father of Canaan, remember? And Canaan committed some sort of despicable act with Noah. Then you read the other sons of Ham, you come all the way down to Sodom and Gomorrah. We know what they were like. So it seems that this aspect of bad behavior and sexual misbehavior seemed to be very much stuck in the family of Ham and Canaan and all the way down to Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 21. And children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. The sons of Shem were Elam, Ashur, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arphaxad begot Selah, and Selah begot Eber. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. And it says that in the days of Peleg the earth was divided. There is some indication that that was actually a physical division of the earth, and that many of the continents actually broke up at that time into individual parts and drifted away, and so the earth itself was physically divided at that time. And there is even an indication from some astronomical records that there was an asteroid or something hit the earth about that time and actually played a part in breaking up the physical fabric of the earth. Verse 26, Joktan begot Almodad, Sheleph, Hazarmaveth, Jera, Hadaram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Ibamael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. These aren't particularly common names nowadays, of course. It's easy for those of the read Fred and Tom and Dick and Harry and Mary and Bob and all the rest of it. And their dwelling place was from Mesha as you go towards Sephar, the mountain of the east. These were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations. These were the families of the sons of Noah, according to their generations, in their nations. And from these the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. So it lays down in chapter 10 the original identity and source of the world's nations. And although it's a bit sort of, you don't get much out of that when you read through it, not quickly at least, if you are a person of enormous energy and persistence and you've got a lot of time on your hands and you've got a few, well, I guess the internet helps today, you could actually go through histories of Tibet and Nepal and parts of India and so on, and you could track the Red Indian tribes one by one. You could virtually bring them all the way back here to these individuals who are named. It actually is, it's the origin of the nations of the earth. And although it looks a bit sort of humdrum as you read through it, for those who are of a historical bent, it's very, very useful information. Anyway, carrying on now to chapter 11. Now, the whole earth had one language and one speech at this particular time. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. This particular part of the country where they landed had got a great deal of material that was good for building, you know, very strong bricks and the masonry and so on. This asphalt which they had was a very strong type of mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Which, in fact, was rebellion already, because God wanted people to multiply and replenish and fill the whole earth. God wanted them to divide and populate the earth. And, of course, the races, those who were yellow versus black versus white, were to separate. They were not to intermarry as they tried to do just before the flood. So here was apparently another attempt at rebellion. Let's stick together. We don't want to be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth the way that this God wants us to. So let's build a city here, and let's build us a tower whose top is in the heavens. Now, there are other possible interpretations of this tower. It certainly was going to be a high tower. Perhaps they had visions of another flood arriving, and this would be a place to hide, the top of this high tower. But a probably more plausible explanation is that it would be a tower whose top would have a temple on it, and that the temple built on the top of this huge tower would be inscribed with the zodiac, the signs of the heavens. There's some information available which indicates that that was the intention, that already they were worshipping the heavens and the planets and so on. They knew a great deal about some of God's message, which is actually shown in the stars and the constellations. And it does seem to be the case that their intention was to build a very high tower, have a temple erected at the top of it, and in this temple would be zodiacal signs and other mystical observances. But, verse 5, the Eternal came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. So, although God can see from heaven and can use his spirit and so on, he actually decided to come down and have a closer look. And the Eternal said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them." So God understood that, you know, this is getting out of hand again, you know. This people, they all speak the same language. They communicate perfectly well with each other. They're building this great city. They've got this huge design to build this great tower with whatever was going to be in the top of it. And look, they've got such a vivid imagination, such a skill, such a drive, such intelligence, that whatever they propose to do, they will accomplish. And really, this was too soon for God's purpose. You know, God has a 6,000-year plan in mind. I think we know that. There are 6 days in the week when we are to labor and do all our work. Then on the seventh day, we are to cease from our physical labors. God has set apart 6,000 years for man to labor, and for Satan, if you like, to labor. And the seventh millennial day is set apart for God, for his purpose. So God was requiring 6,000 years to elapse before moving into the next stage. And here it seems that man was just so clever, so bright, able to pool his resources so effectively, that it says there, you know, this one thing they begin to do now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. And there is some indication, again only sketchy information, that way back in ancient times, that the ancients had batteries, that they could do all sorts of complicated operations on people's brains, that they possibly had the power of flight. There's a number of intriguing, sketchy sort of remnants from those days. In other words, people of that time were incredibly intelligent, industrious, had great ability, and had God just let it carry on, we would have got to today's stage of nuclear warfare probably centuries ago. So God said, come, verse 7, let us go down there, confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. And that's what God did. So the Eternal scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Eternal confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Eternal scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. So you see, once people can't talk to each other, it's difficult to collaborate. And we know that today. Even within the churches of God, it's hard to really get close to and work with people who speak Spanish or French or Italian or French, whatever it might be. It's difficult. You know, even today with our ability to train people in languages and our translating devices, it's very hard. And so back in these days, by God confounding the language, and suddenly there's a bunch of people working together, and one says, you know, pass me those bricks. And the guy thinks, what's he saying? He's just talking gibberish to me. And he talks back in perhaps Chinese. Another guy thinks, what's he doing? Has he been drinking or something? I can pass me the bricks. And suddenly, you know, there's 100 people working together with 100 different languages. And they really can't do a thing. They can't even discuss when to start work, when to stop, when to take a lunch break. They can make no plans at all, because all of a sudden, they're all speaking a different language, a different tongue, even writing differently. They can't even write it down. They've got a different set of signs now. One writes in sort of Chinese script, another writes in sort of a Russian Cyrillic, another writes in our sort of Western font. So that was the end of man's great plans of working together, and that in fact separated mankind right up till recent times. It's only in the last perhaps 10, 20, 30 years that man has got the ability to more or less communicate all in one tongue. It's not easy, but there are a number of interpreters now who can do simultaneous translations, and so at the United Nations and places like that, you can get all tribes of the earth coming together into one big hall. They strap on their earpieces, and a whole panel of translators sit there listening to the main speaker and translate simultaneously into 100 different languages. So now today, after the lapse of nearly 4,000 years, we're getting back pretty much to the days of pre-Babel. Anyway, carrying on in verse 10 now. This is the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. After he begot Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and begot sons and daughters. And I said earlier, you know, Shem actually almost outlived Abraham. They certainly lived together for a good 100 years plus. Arphaxad lived 35 years and begot Selah. And it's interesting here that before the flood, people lived often 100 years and begot sons and daughters, and then lived on a few hundred more years and died at the age of 800 or 900. But once we're past the flood now, we see that people's lifespans start to shorten very dramatically. And also, they seem to mature much more quickly because now they're having children at a much earlier age. Arphaxad had only 35 years, begot Selah. After he begot Selah, Arphaxad lived 403 years and begot sons and daughters. Selah lived 30 years and begot Eber. After he begot Eber, Selah lived 403 years and begot sons and daughters. Eber lived 34 years and begot Peleg. After he begot Peleg, Eber lived 430 years and begot sons and daughters. And Peleg is the guy in whose days the earth was physically divided, it appears. Peleg lived 30 years and begot Reu. After he begot Reu, Peleg lived 209 years and begot sons and daughters. Reu lived 32 years and begot Serug. After he begot Serug, Reu lived 207 years and begot sons and daughters. Serug lived 30 years and begot Nahor. After he begot Nahor, Serug lived 200 years and begot sons and daughters. So you can see here that the 900s are now down to like 200s. So a dramatic shortening of the age of mankind. And one possible explanation, we can't be sure, is that in the flood, if the water canopy which surrounded the earth, if there was one, if that collapsed and was not replaced, then the solar radiation from the sun might have had an effect upon the quality of life, on people's longevity. So the 900s, 800s become now 300s and now 200s. Verse 24, Nahor lived 29 years, which is now a spring chicken at this age, and begot Terah. After begot Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and begot sons and daughters. This is premature, isn't it? You're living only 119 more years as opposed to the previous 800 odd. Now Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And we're starting to focus in now, really, because the story is about to pick up after the first 2,000 years of man's history are now nearly over. We're getting down to pick up the story of a particular man, Abraham, and of course the rest of the Bible, in a sense, is the story of Abraham and his descendants. So although we've seen lots of different individuals so far and different parts of the genealogy and different families, it's now narrowing down deliberately because we're about to move out of this ancient period into almost more recent history. Verse 27, this is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no child. So up to now you've got all these various genealogies, which are very important historically, very important at the time, of course, but suddenly Abram's genealogy, so to speak, has hit a bit of a cul-de-sac, a bit of a dead end, because we can't name Abram's sons here because Sarai is barren. Even as a relatively young woman, she was unable to have any children. She had no child. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And so we get to the end of all these general tales of ancient times, the days of Noah now long behind us, the flood, of course, long behind us, Tower of Babel now some time behind us. And now we've followed the history of various people all the way down to a key figure in God's purpose and plan, and, we have to say, a key figure in the world tomorrow. Because I think we know that Abraham, as he subsequently became known, is going to be one of the chiefest individuals in the kingdom of God. A very, very important individual. He will have huge responsibility. He's a major figure of both the Old Testament He's also mentioned a number of times in the New Testament, and in God's kingdom, as a resurrected spirit being, Abraham is a major figure. I think we'll try and at least to move on a little bit, since we've made some progress today. We'll at least get through, I'm sure, he says, hopefully, chapter 12. That would be a good start. So, chapter 12, and we now move into the story of a very, very special individual. Now, the Eternal had said to Abraham, "Get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation." Now, here's Abraham with a barren wife, okay? No descendants. "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So these are like rather astonishing promises. So here's Jehovah God talking to Abraham and saying, "I'm going to make you into a great nation." Well, a great nation means, well, great in numbers, great in wealth, great in its power and influence. But whatever it means a great nation. And here's a guy who's got no son, no family. So Abraham departed as Eternal had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. That's his nephew. And Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abraham took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. So it's some distance to go. If you look at a map, you'll see it's a fair distance to travel. But Abraham's been given a pretty good promise from Jehovah, and he's very happy to go along. Abraham passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were then in the land. Then the Eternal appeared to Abraham and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." Remember, this stage there is no descendant. And there he built an altar to the Eternal who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west, and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Eternal, and called on the name of the Eternal. So Abram journeyed, going on still, towards the south, or my margin says the Negev, which is a part of southern Israel today. Now there was a famine in the land. This happened a number of times over there. And apparently the land of Israel in those days, the land we know of as Israel in those days, was quite fertile. Much, much more so than today, which it looks like when we went to keep the feast in Jerusalem in 1981. And we hired a car and drove from Jerusalem up north to the Galilee area, Lake Tiberias and so on. And really, for 100 miles, it's just like driving along through the moon. It's just a barren rock, sand. There's nothing lives at all. It's a horrible land, in a sense, to drive through. Just absolute barren, rocky, bone dry, dusty desert. But in these days, the days of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, much of that land was actually exceedingly fertile, with lakes and forests and rivers and streams and orchards. But at this particular moment in time, there was a famine. It says, "There was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, 'Indeed, I know you are a woman of beautiful countenance.'" I guess she was quite flattered by that. Nice to hear your husband make those comments to you. "And therefore, it will happen, when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live." So he's a bit fearful, is Abraham. And he does seem to have a little bit of in his character, a little bit sort of fearful, a little bit sort of nervous. And so he's a bit sort of fearful here that, you know, you're so beautiful that they're bound to lust after you. And there's no doubt the Pharaoh's going to want you in his harem. And so he's going to bump me off because, you know, so that's going to be bad news for me. "Please say that you're my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Because if they think, you know, I'm your brother, they'll take more care of me, because they want to please you and impress you and cultivate your favor. And therefore, if I'm your brother, you see, then they're going to sort of actually look after me more. So you say that you're my sister, which was a half-truth, because in fact Sarai was his half-sister. So it was, verse 14, when Abram came into Egypt, that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. And I guess you've got to say that, you know, she must really have been a striking female, because Abram suspected they'd say this. When she got down there, the Egyptians, plural, saw the woman, that she was not beautiful. It says that she was very beautiful. This is God's inspired word, so one assumes that Sarai was an absolute, you know, Eiffel, striking, gorgeous, radiant, you know, a figure to behold. And the princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. And they said, wow, look at this female, woof. So the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. So they reported straight away, look, Pharaoh, there's a girl, a young woman come into your country who would knock your eyes out. And you want to come and see this lass. And so he heard about her, and she was invited to come to Pharaoh's house, which probably means sort of joining his harem, one imagines. Verse 16, he treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep and oxen and male donkeys and male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. So as Abram suspected, they're going to look after me because they want to, you know, curry favor with you. But Jehovah plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this that you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Because the Pharaoh recognized that had he taken another man's wife, that would have been a serious sin of adultery. And people knew even in those days that some things were not to be done. And so, you know, Pharaoh sent Abram away with Sarai. But Abram got something out of it, even though in a sense you could say it wasn't very noble conduct on his part. But he was sent away with all the possessions that the Pharaoh had given him. So he went down in a situation of famine. And he returned out of Egypt more richly blessed than when he went in. Get his wife back, plus of course all the oxen and the sheep and the donkeys and the camels, and presumably may have even kept the servants that were given to him. So if you like, Abram became even wealthier, went back to his own country here in a much more wealthy and prosperous position than when he started, because even though he'd told a half-truth, a so-called white lie, nonetheless, God was looking after his man, because he had really great plans for Abram, as we'll see when we continue the story. So I think at that point, brethren, we will finish for today. We made good progress, and the story of Abram and his son Isaac and then Jacob is of major importance to us in God's church today, and has implications for us even to these very days. So that's good progress. I'm glad we've got that far, and we'll continue the story again at another time. That's all for now.